we know that we share the Tongass, that at a powerful fundamental level, the Tongass is a native place.
The new Sea Alaska Lands Bill gets a hearing in the U.S. Senate. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, May 25th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, cleaning up debris underwater in the harbor in Unalaska.
Every now and then we find cool stuff. Stuff we get to keep.
Like?
Old bowls. Coffee cups, bowls left over from the war.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
And by
Full Circle. Full Circle grows, picks, and delivers fresh, certified organic produce year-round. More information about their 400-acre farm and their organic partners at fullcircle.com.
The Sea Alaska Native Corporation was in Washington today, making its case to select lands in the Tongass National Forest. It's a fight that's been going on for years, and one that's caused intense controversy in Southeast Alaska. Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski acknowledged how divisive the issue has been.
It is one that I admit has brought controversy between neighbors, and that is unfortunate. But at the end of the day, we are all still neighbors there, and we need to figure out how we remain in our communities.
Murkowski supports Sea Alaska's land selections and has authored a bill that has backing on the other side of the political aisle from Democratic Senator Mark Begich. Murkowski introduced a revised Sea Alaska lands bill last month after hearing an outcry from some Southeast Alaskans upset that Sea Alaska would take lands currently used for hunting, fishing, and tourism and deemed ecologically sensitive. The current bill would let the corporation choose from among 79,000 acres on Prince of Wales on Kosciuszko Islands, mostly for timber use, and additional lands would be set aside for tourism and as sacred or cultural sites. It still goes too far, according to some, like Myla Polstra of Edna Bay, who testified before the Senate Energy Committee today against the bill called S-730.
Many in the towns feel like an endangered species, threatened to the core by S-730, which we view as a land grab by Sea Alaska Corporation. Our business investments in very communities are imperiled by this legislation.
The Obama administration voiced its objections, even as it said it's time to finalize a deal. Harris Sherman, Undersecretary for Natural Resources and Environment at the Agriculture Department, says Sea Alaska's picks may hurt local mills.
The lands identified by Sea Alaska for timber development overlap to a considerable extent with lands that are critical to the success of the Forest Service's transition strategy in the next 10 to 15 years. These lands are central to providing local mills with sustainable, dependable wood for the foreseeable future. These are lands that the Forest Service has invested in the neighborhood of $50 million to prepare for second growth opportunities.
But Senator Murkowski warned that without the land swap, local timber in Southeast will die. And Sea Alaska says this is a unique situation and that the corporation is entitled to make selections under the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, or ANCSA. Board member Byron Malott testified that allowing the corporation to make the selections won't be doing something special, but will instead be showing it respect.
We know that we share the Tongass. But at a powerful fundamental level, the Tongass is a native place. Centuries and generations and literally millennia of the history of our people live in that land. And we have seen our people, particularly from 1900 on, literally ripped from that land.
While Senator Murkowski has adjusted her bill after public comment, Congressman Don Young has not made changes to the version introduced last year. Tomorrow, it will get an airing over in the House in the Indian Affairs Subcommittee he chairs. For most people, cleaning up litter means walking along roads and picking up empty soda cans. But for one group in Unalaska, it means dragging up boat parts and fishing nets from the floor of the harbor. KUCB's Alexandra Gutierrez has more.
Recently, local drivers saw dozens of big yellow bags of garbage lining the main road. That was the past year's litter, collected by volunteers for the annual cleanup week. But on top of all that trash, there's also plenty of litter in the area that Unalaskans don't see. This weekend, a group of scuba divers swam beneath fishing vessels to collect marine debris that might be harmful to plant and animal life.
Where are we going? What's that? Where are we going? We're going to go down and then that way.
The divers went to the small boat harbor on Saturday and then down to the spit dock on Sunday. Reed Brewer explains what the Unalaska Divers Association was hoping to accomplish.
We've got some volunteer divers that are working to clean up some particular sites under Unalaska's docks. Yesterday we were at the small boat harbor for our, I think, fourth year in a row. And you can actually see a very distinct difference in the amount of garbage at the sea float.
He says that while most people don't realize it, there's a pretty wide variety of junk beneath the water.
We did find a number of tires, an inflatable skiff that was down, a bunch of metal, a bunch of, you know, kind of rotting stuff, and we're able to get it on the beach, up to the docks.
Chris Graves helped lead the shore support on behalf of the city's ports department, and she coordinated volunteers from UNICE. She says that there's a lot of stuff down underwater that's been there for decades, and that it doesn't just come from fishing vessels.
It's unfortunately, there's a lot of stuff here from World War II, too.
The Unalaska Divers Association has been doing their marine debris cleanup for a while now, but this is the first time they've done it at the spit docks, says Roger Deffendahl.
We haven't been out here to the spit yet in the 4 years now we've been doing this. I think it's been 4 years now. So we're kind of figuring we're going to be getting a lot of garbage.
Before entering the harbor, the divers joked about ways to discourage vessels from dropping their trash overboard.
We can give them awards based on beauty, like, you know, yard awards or something.
Exactly. And we'll just call it the slip of shame.
Don Graves was one of the five divers at the spit dock on Sunday, and he says that the worst debris contains chemicals that are harmful to the ecosystem.
Batteries are nasty because of chemical side. In order, if they toss oil filters or, you know, yesterday we pulled the housing off from a reduction gear, so I'm sure there was grease and stuff like that in on all that stuff.
Keel cooler.
You know, and it's like, why? You got dumpsters close by.
Deffendahl adds that nets and crab pods also shouldn't be tossed in the water, since they can trap seabirds that dive for their food.
You'll see the skeletons of birds that have gotten down in there. And they got turned around, they can't back out.
But while the divers mostly find industrial gear, they also sometimes find things that they can reuse.
Every now and then we find cool stuff. Stuff we get to keep.
Like?
Old coffee cups, bowls left over from the war.
Well, there was a fishing rod last year that was
fishing
found.
Rod last year that was real good. Sunglasses. Yeah, we appreciate
flower
everybody.
Pots.
Yeah, flower pots.
Though the volunteers have a good time diving for the cleanup, they also say that it's tough work.
It's fun, but it's not as easy as people think. Yeah. It's like you start putting all this on, you got, you know, 30 pounds of weight or whatever on average, and all your gear and everything else. It's a lot of stuff to lug around.
Yeah, for some people it's a lot of work. For other people it's pretty easy.
Yeah. By the end of the weekend, over 2,000 pounds of debris were picked up by the divers and then lugged off to the landfill. In Unalaska, I'm Alexander Gutierrez.
I got a heavy one. Who's the strongest guy?
Probably there one of the guys down there.
I'll come to you.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, lawmakers are asked to call themselves into special session to deal with coastal management.
This should be a fairly easy process, assuming we can get 40 people to agree to come back to do it.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Alaska lawmakers are being polled today to see if there is enough support to call themselves into special session to deal with the coastal management program. Senate President Kodiak Republican Gary Stevens sent out the email to lawmakers. Senator Stevens was not available today, but Senate Majority Leader Anchorage Republican Kevin Meyer says if enough lawmakers agree, the session would be held next week on May 31st and would take only a day or two. The coastal management program will end by June 30th unless lawmakers and the governor pass legislation that keeps it going. Meyer says the House version passed unanimously, but the Senate tried to tweak it a bit.
Apparently, we modified it too much because the House then, you know, wouldn't agree to our changes, and hence the bill died. So I think what's going to happen is that we're going to find some compromise or even use what the House has already passed. Because again, as far as we're concerned, the Senate, something is better than nothing.
Meyer says Bethel Senator Lyman Hoffman and Nome Senator Donnie Olson are working to craft a compromise in the hope that lawmakers can quickly pass a bill.
And it's my understanding that they were willing to pretty much accept what the House had passed initially. So again, if that's truly the case, then this should be a fairly easy process, assuming we can get 40 people to agree to come back to do it.
It takes a two-thirds majority of the legislature to call a special session. The governor could also call lawmakers back to deal with the issue, but he would have to give them 30 days' notice, so it would have to have happen within the next few days to make the deadline before the ACMP dies. Anchorage Democrat Senator Bill Willikowski has been urging action on the law. He says the program has existed for more than 30 years, and if it expires, Alaska, with more coastline than all other states combined, would be the only coastal state not to have a program in place. Willikowski says the program allows the state and coastal communities to have a formal seat at the table and impacts federal development on everything from timber in the Tongass to oil and gas development in the Chukchi and Beaufort Sea. It's also tied to millions in federal funds. He says the Federal Deepwater Port Act requires the state to have a coastal management program before a port for resource development could be built.
Without ACMP, oil and gas operators will not have the option to develop an offshore deepwater port, which could significantly impair their operations. So this will have a significant impact on oil and gas exploration in Alaska. It'll have a significant impact on other development, mining, timber, and it'll also take away coastal communities' ability to have public comment on a formal place at the table.
Willikowski says he believes a compromise can be achieved quickly and lawmakers would not have to be in Juneau for long. But he says if the streamlined process goes away for permitting and the state and local communities lose the ability to be involved, everyone loses.
Lose situation for the developers. It's a lose situation for local communities. It's a lose situation for the state. We lose anywhere between 30 and 120 employees in the state. We lose millions of dollars of federal funds. We lose the ability to get additional federal funds that may be available through other federal legislation. We lose the ability to get a deep water port. So no one wins in the loss of this program, in my opinion.
Senator Myers says the hope is that a decision regarding the special session can be made by tomorrow. A polar bear cub rescued from the North Slope last month is making a quick recovery at the Alaska Zoo. The female cub of the year was underweight and weak when she was found at the Alpine oil field, separated from her mother. The cub faced certain death in the wild, so the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service decided to rescue her. She'll become an ambassador for her species at a zoo in the lower 48. APRN's Annie Fite was at the zoo today for the cub's first introduction to life in the spotlight.
At 34 pounds, the cub is a white puffball of complete cuteness. When her steel door first swung open, she took a few tentative steps outside. Then she slowly began exploring her outdoor enclosure, sniffing the dirt ground and pawing at objects. After several minutes, she got bolder and sniffed her way up to the front of the enclosure, where a bank of TV cameras were capturing her every move. Zoo director Pat Lampe leaned back on a wooden fence, clearly enjoying the moment.
Yeah, she's probably going to be getting more and more bold now, because nothing bad happened when she did that.
He gave a play-by-play as the bear retreated back to safety indoors.
Let's check. One more look. Yeah. Yeah, everything's... All my stuff's still there. Nobody took it. And she'll come right back out.
This event was designed to introduce the bear to the media and to get her used to being on exhibit. Lampe says he was very pleased to see how relaxed she was in front of the public.
You know, more people, a little more activity level. You know, she seems very involved with what she's doing out there and not paying us a whole bunch of attention, which is what we want, is her just to explore and, you know, get a lot of good exercise and acclimate to different sights and sounds, because, you know, that's what she's going to be facing in her future.
The cub won't stay at the Alaska Zoo. There are already two polar bears here, so there isn't room for her in the exhibit. But Lampe says she won't have any trouble finding a good home.
Having an orphan from a fresh bloodline is very exciting stuff. You know, we would all wish that, you know, she could have continued on with her mother and stayed in a family unit out in the wild, but yeah. Since that didn't happen, you know, people would feel very fortunate to have her.
The cub has doubled her weight since arriving at the zoo late last month, and Lampe says she's gotten much stronger. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service picked her up on April 29th. She had separated from her mother and had no chance of survival in the wild. Rosa Meehan is head of the agency's Marine Mammal Division in Anchorage and helped organize the effort. She says the last time the service had an orphan polar bear was 10 years ago.
Female polar bears are very have very strong maternal instincts. They've got a tremendous investment in their offspring, and so it just is very unusual.
The survival rate for cubs in the wild in the 1990s was about 65%. More recent studies show that number has declined to 40%. Meehan says that's one factor that led to the bear's listing as threatened on the endangered species list.
It's this kind of a statistic that indicates the population is in trouble, it is declining, and so that supported our decision to list him under the Endangered Species Act.
No one can say for sure why this cub was abandoned by its mother. Fish and wildlife biologist Susie Miller says a lot of factors may have been involved.
This cub was very small, so it could be related to the cub's mass. She might not have been able to keep up with her mom, or it could be that she wasn't able to navigate through ice or rubble, or that she had was under thermal stress. They don't have a lot of fat when they're that young, and if they have to swim, that can be quite difficult for them and stress them out. So those are all other factors that might have played into why she got separated from her mom.
The Fish and Wildlife Service will make a decision soon on where the cub will go. A national zoo organization is recommending the Louisville Zoo in Kentucky. That zoo already has a 1.5-year-old male polar bear cub that would be a good social mate for this cub. Zoo director Pat Lampe says it will be hard to see the cub go. He's already gotten a read on her developing personality.
This one's a little Miss Independence and very, very sure of herself.
How so?
Oh, she just does. Her whole attitude seems to be very confident in her areas. Once she's comfortable with the inside, it's like she owns it. She's quite the little pistol.
Before she leaves for her new home, Anchorage residents will have a chance to see her. The zoo plans to have her outside twice a day between 11 and noon and 4 and 5 p.m. as long as her adjustment continues to go well. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment. On the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by
the Center for Distance Education at UAF, offering access to online courses from any location. Information at distance.uaf.edu/learn.
Two climbers have been killed in an avalanche in Denali National Park. The Park Service reports that 33-year-old Jiro Kurihara of Canmore, Alberta, and 28-year-old Junya Shirioshi of Sapporo, Japan, were found dead in avalanche debris near the base of Mount Francis, a 10,400-foot peak near Mount McKinley. National Park spokeswoman Maureen McLaughlin says the men were experienced climbers with plans to attempt a previously unscaled route.
From what we understand, they had intended to climb a new route on the west face of Mount Francis on, it was May 21st, and they did not return from that climb. After a couple days where they had not returned to their camp, we went and took a look And it did appear that they had died in an avalanche. Much more than that, we don't know at this time.
The body of one of the climbers was spotted from the air yesterday by rangers aboard a Park Service chartered helicopter. Rangers returned this morning and found the other climber's body and evacuated both of the dead by helicopter from the mountain. McLaughlin says conditions and timing may have played into the deadly avalanche.
Probably saw some snow the day before. On Friday the 20th, there was a bit of a small snowstorm, about 9 inches of snow. These folks started climbing the day after that, which was a warm, pretty sunny day. And again, we're not sure what triggered it, but that west face does have quite a bit of sun exposure in the afternoon.
McLaughlin says the route where the avalanche occurred includes mixed snow, ice, and rock, including 45 to 50 degree slopes. She says Mount Francis is a popular add-on climb for Denali mountaineers because of its close proximity to Mount McKinley and that the men killed had already climbed the larger peak. There are several technically challenging routes on Mount Francis, which normally sees 10 to 12 attempts per year, mostly via the southwest or east ridge. Beginning on July 1st, buying alcohol at a package store in Anchorage will require photo identification. Last night, the Anchorage Assembly approved the new law by a 10-to-1 margin. KSKA's Len Anderson has details.
There are some people who believe that this isn't going to do very much.
Assembly Chair Debbie Osiander, who, along with member Adam Trombley, sponsored the version of the photo ID requirement that finally won approval after several proposals, debate, and a voter advisory. Osiander said it was probably the 2-to-1 backing by voters in the April municipal election that was the overriding factor.
For me, there's an incredibly strong statement if the voters say do something. I actually had some skepticism that this would pass on the ballot. But when it did, that, in a sense, was a mandate for me. And I think for many of the Assembly members to do what the public had asked us to do.
Proponents say the photo ID law will help curb minors purchasing alcohol, as well as those the court has banned from buying alcohol because of driving or other convictions involving alcohol. Many of those individuals are ordered to carry driver's licenses bearing a red stripe. Opponents argue such people will simply use other photo IDs. Backers say if the ID check only stops a few individuals, it's still worthwhile. Osiander noted that Assemblymember Chris Birch, along with some testifying during the public hearing, urged electronic ankle bracelet monitoring rather than photo IDs.
In the end, I think the basic consensus was that that technology just wasn't there quite yet.
Birch was one of the 10 who voted for the ordinance. Bill Starr was the sole vote against. At an earlier May 10th Assembly meeting, Municipal Attorney Dennis Wheeler said he was unsure if the photo ID requirement usurped state law, which places no such demand on any businesses selling alcohol. After passage, Wheeler said in a phone conversation that, quote, those concerns have not been diminished by the passage of the ordinance. Wheeler also commented upon another issue that arose during the ID photo debate. Fairbanks has nearly twice as many residents with red stripe driver's licenses than Anchorage, which officially has just under 500. But over 1,000 Anchorage residents have court orders to obtain the red stripe licenses. Wheeler observed Anchorage has a large number of alcohol-related cases, including driving, assaults, and domestic abuse. The driving violations, about 2,000, are all misdemeanors. Felony situations fall to the state. There are also about 8,000 to 10,000 other alcohol-related cases coming before the municipal prosecutor. Unlike Fairbanks, where no alcohol is a common request, Wheeler says the municipality's demands vary.
There are a variety of tools that we have available to us for dealing with those issues in terms of both sentencing and treatment. Given that those options exist, the addition of the red stripe doesn't really change the playing field in terms of the options available to us. It doesn't add anything of real value at this point.
Wheeler also says many who are ordered to obtain red stripe licenses but don't are just like those whose license is suspended or revoked. They drive anyway. At a Wednesday press conference, Mayor Dan Sullivan says he has not yet determined how he regards the new requirement. He has 7 business days to decide whether or not he would like to attempt a veto in the face of that 10-1 margin. That is, if he were able to issue a veto. Mayor Sullivan owns a minority interest in a downtown bar, and the city ethics board must first determine if he has a conflict of interest. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
The Fairbanks Wellness Court holds a commencement ceremony tomorrow for graduates of the Alternative Justice Program. The Wellness Court, which started in 2007, provides intensive outpatient substance abuse treatment, monitoring, and work or education requirements as an alternative to jail time or other penalties. Therapeutic Court Coordinator Janice Lorenzen says the program primarily works with driving under the influence offenders, employing a system proven over the last 2 decades in similar courts in the lower 48.
You have a multidisciplinary team that looks very different than your typical court process would, and that's made up of the DA, the counsel, the judges, myself as a coordinator, the probation officer, and the service providers. And it's very different in the fact that it's not as adversarial, and that you come together on behalf of that individual. That team's responsible for the monitoring the person while they're in the program.
Lorenzen says the Fairbanks Wellness Court program has involved a learning process, but has been pretty successful.
We've had a total of 101 individuals that have come through, and we've had 20 graduates, and that's part of what the ceremony is going to recognize is not only the most current graduates, but also the individuals that have been successful since they have left.
Lorenzen says only 1 of 20 Fairbanks Wellness Court graduates have had another DUI offense. She says the program is currently operating at capacity with 30 participants. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Alexandra Gutierrez in Unalaska, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Len Anderson in Anchorage. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
And by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. Crowley.com.
The University of Alaska Fairbanks now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.